Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 4, Side 1.
I may forget that painted, feathered face and screaming mouth one of these days, but I doubt it. I was hanging, helpless, the prairie flying along 2 yards below as he swung up the hatchet. And then there were squeals of rage, and Black Aphrodite was thrashing at him with a parasol. God bless her. He clung like a leech with one hand, stubbornly determined to disembowel me with the other. But the clever, beautiful, resourceful pearl of African womanhood abandoned edge for point and gave him the ferrule in the groin. He shrieked and tumbled off under the hooves of the team behind, and I hauled myself inboard and looked about to see what fresh horror was offering itself. It was a battle royal. The Indians were strung out along the train, firing bows and pieces, and the Savagneros were giving them volley for volley. But some of the bolder spirits, like the chap who'd experienced Aphrodite's caress, were riding in among the wagons, sliding down the offside of their ponies for protection, trying to get close enough to scupper our teams. I saw men and ponies go down, an arrow zipped into the furled canvas overhead, and when I emerged from the trollops for another peep, there was a wicked little red bastard in a war bonnet alongside the lead mule of the wagon behind, driving his lance into its flank. The poor brute screamed and went down, bringing the others with him in a kicking tangle. The wagon lurched crazily, hung for a sickening moment, and then crashed down, scattering cases of claret all over the trail. Then our own wagon bucked like fury, and I was thrown headlong and fetched up against the sideboard with all the breath driven out of me. I scrambled up, and if it isn't one damn thing, it's another. There was an Indian on our driver's seat now, disputing the reins with the teamster. The reins fell free as they grappled, and it was a stone certainty that we'd be over in 2 seconds if steps were not taken. I never join in unless I must, but now there was nothing for it but to fight my way through a press of hysterical whores, of whom there now seemed to be about 50, rolling underfoot, striking out blindly or swooning in my path. I lurched over the front board and got a fist into the Indian's braids and hauled. The teamster slashed at him with a bowie, and as he dropped away howling, I grabbed the reins and flung my weight on to steady the team. The teamster took hold, and I looked ahead and almost lost my balance in sheer astonishment. We were on open plain, with the three carriages flying along before us, and beyond them was one of the most beautiful and unbelievable sights I ever beheld. It was a castle, just as Grattan had said, with two great round towers, massive walls of what looked like brown stone, and a beetling gateway, with the stars and stripes fluttering in the breeze. I yelled with joy and amazement as we lumbered down towards it, and then became aware that the shots and yells were dying away behind. I looked back, and there were 5 wagons spread out across the plain, which meant that 2 were goners, and in their wake the Indians were slackening in their pursuit, waving their weapons and whooping. I could see some of them clustered round the wrecked wagon, no doubt preparing to sample the claret as soon as the chief had swilled the first glassful round his palate. Susie's carriage was making for the open gateway, and as the invalid's vehicle slowed, my teamster reined in almost to a walk. I jumped down, watching the remaining wagons trundling in. One had smoke rising from its smouldering canvas. Another was rolling drunkenly with a displaced axle. But at least they were safe, and Grattan and 2 of the Savagneros were on foot, rifles at the ready, acting as a rear guard. The carriages were inside, and as the first wagon followed with its wailing occupants, all but Aphrodite, who was thrashing the tailboard with the remains of her gamp, in a fine berserk fury still, I hurried through the gates. I had a fleeting impression of a great courtyard surrounded by 2 stories of buildings, and then I was up a flight of steps to the parapet above the main gate. Just beneath me, the last 4 wagons were crowded in about the gateway. Grattan, his rifle cradled, gave me a wave. Beyond lay the empty plain for 1/4 mile to the bend of the river, where about 12 Indians were milling to and fro, but making no move towards the fort. Behind them I could see the wrecked wagon beside the cottonwoods fringing the river. And then I sank down in nervous exhaustion by the wall. My shoulder was skinned and throbbing from my tumble. There was caked blood on the back of my hand. God knew whose it was. Feet were running up the steps, and Grattan appeared, his face grimed and grinning.
"Will you have nuts or a cigar, sir?"
says he, and I hauled myself up. Beneath us I could hear the great gates being hauled to, and the Savanieros and teamsters' voices raised in oaths of relief. Down in the courtyard the wagons were any old how, and the beasts were braying and roaring, with the wails of the sluts added to the din. The invalids were climbing out, shaken and bewildered. I saw Susie with her face pale and her hair all awry. Then Grattan says,
"Jesus Christ!"
And I saw he was staring round in wonder. I stared, too, at the crowded courtyard and our dazed following, at the huddle of wagons and beasts, at the silent buildings, the great round towers, the broad upper walks and parapets, at Old Glory over our heads. And I realized why Grattan, that soft-spoken man, had blasphemed. There wasn't a soul in Bent's Fort but ourselves. Chapter 7. I know now, of course, why it was so. That William Bent was crazy, and had abandoned his wonderful fortress to fate and the Death Watch beetle, or whatever bugs they have out there. But at the time, it was a mystery beyond belief. Here we were, winded and terrified after a chase by those infernal savages, home by the skin of our teeth, and the place that should have been swarming with people was empty, but with its flag flying and not a chair out of place. For while the teamsters and Savanieros mounted guard and saw to the beasts, and the rest occupied the ground floor rooms and prepared food and tended our two or three injured, Grattan and I went over the whole place from attic to cellar, and there wasn't so much as a mouse. It was an incredible citadel, though deserted as it was. I suppose it will be about 100 paces square, but I can't be sure from memory, with adobe walls 20 feet high and stout enough to resist a battering ram. There were two huge towers, like martellos, at opposite corners. Against the north wall were two stories of buildings with fine, cool rooms, and opposite them, across the square, a shaded arcade of shops and trade rooms. Inside the gate wall were chambers for guards and servants, with stoves and fireplaces, and on the west end were a cooper's and joiner's shops, a forge, and storehouses. The roofs of all these buildings formed broad walks running inside the upper ramparts. On this level, at the west end, there was even a little house with a porch for the commandant, and a billiard room, damn it, which Grattan had sworn to, and I hadn't believed, with the pills still lying on the bays. I was so astounded that I picked up a cue and slapped the red away. And not 10 minutes earlier, I'd been hanging upside down from a wagon tail trying to avoid being tomahawked. "I don't believe this bloody place," says I, while Grattan replaced the balls and blew away. He made nothing of it. "Where the deuce have they gone?" For that was the eerie thing. The only thing absent was the people themselves. Wherever we went, all was in order. A dining room with oak furniture and a linen cloth on the table. Presses bursting with china and glass. A wine cooler with bottles of 42 Burgundy. Captain's biscuits in a barrel. A piece of cheese kicking up a hell of a row in the sideboard. And a portrait of Andrew Jackson on the wall. It was the same in the shops. The blacksmith tools were there, and the carpenter's gear. The trade rooms were stuffed with pelts, buffalo robes, bits, axes, nails, candles, God knows what. As I live, there was even sealing wax and writing paper. The storerooms had provisions for an army, and hogsheads of wine and spirits. In the sleeping quarters, some of the beds were made. There was a posy of withered flowers in a vase on the commandant's desk, and a neatly torn newspaper in the privy.
"Whoever it was," says Grattan, "cleared out in a hell of a hurry."
"But why haven't the Indians looted the place?"
"They don't know," says he. "Chances are that Bent, or St. Vrain, or whoever was here, left within the last couple of days. Don't ask me why. The Indians can't know that. I dare say the crowd that chased us are the only ones hereabouts, and new arrivals at that. If they'd known it was deserted, they'd never have left off chasing us."
That was reasonable, but provoked a disquieting thought.
"Do you suppose they'll come back. The Indians, I mean. Depends, says he. There weren't above 30 of the dear fellows, and we sank nigh on a dozen of those. Maybe more'll come in, maybe not. One thing's certain. With our drivers and 7 euros, we muster about 15 rifles, and it'd take 50 to make this place good against an attack. So we best hope that our red friends don't receive any reinforcements.
That had me flying up the ramparts again, to make sure the guards were on the lookout. The Indians were still in view over by the cottonwoods, but no new members so far as I could see. There was a moon due that night, so they couldn't surprise us after dark. I took stock. At least we were inside, and the chances were that a caravan or a party of traders would heave in sight before enough Indians arrived to make the place too hot to hold. An unfortunate choice of expression, that, as you'll come to appreciate. In the meantime, we were in residence, and once I'd heard Susie's exclamations of pleasure at the amenities and the enthusiasm of the trollops as they settled themselves into quarters, and started washing their clothes and chattering in the well-stocked kitchen, where our black cook had pans on the boil, I began to feel better. We didn't make use of the big corral outside the walls, but stabled the beasts in a wagon park off the main square. The teamsters had their own fires going in no time, and were breaking out supplies from the storerooms. There was laughter and singing, and the great empty place echoed with our noise. The invalids took the air on the walls, and one four-eyed idiot even proposed an evening stroll down to the river. I dissuaded him by pointing out that the locals might be taking their hatchets for a walk at the same time. Do you know, he hadn't thought of that. I suppose he imagined that the brutes had pursued us, but been just rather persistent native hawkers trying to interest us in beads and pottery. We had the best hot meal we'd eaten in months, in the dining room, with a pair of the tarts to wait on us, and some tolerable port, and a decent cigar afterwards. I took my turn at guard that night, with only middling apprehension. There wasn't a sign of Indians. The moonlit prairie was empty, as far as one could see, and I was well used to the plaintive howl of the white wolves by now. I turned in shortly before dawn, feeling not half bad. It was snug and jolly to see Susie snoring away in the dim candlelight, with one fine tit peeping out among the frills. I nibbled away until she squirmed into wakefulness, whereafter we set two partners, celebrating the first civilized bed we'd occupied since the Planters' Hotel, if you like. It was comforting afterwards to sip punch and glance round the high whitewashed walls, in the knowledge that they were about 6 feet thick, with sharp eyes aloft, and the Indians could prowl about outside to their heart's content. That's what they were doing, too, next morning, and there must have been a trip in from somewhere during the night, for I counted above 60 of the scoundrels circling their ponies, just out of range, whooping and working up ahead of steam. I had every spare man up to the east rampart above the gate, with the revolving rifles and six-shooters as well as our high walls. We should be safe enough, unless they assembled in greater numbers than were visible now. So I remarked to Grattan, and he went off to the armory in one of the corner towers to see what was available. Just then there was a shout. The Indians had decided to warm us up a little. They charged in, well spread out like good light cavalry, letting fly a few shots and arrows, but plainly bent on testing our fire. I detailed three men only, and we downed one of their ponies. The dismounted brave capered and jeered, and showed us his arse, and the rest drew off to reconsider. There was a chief in a war bonnet who seemed to be haranguing them. Presently he lifted his lance and howled, and the whole crowd came in like banshees, stirrup to stirrup, straight for the gate. "Hold your fire!" bawls I. "Wait for the word!" And I was just about to give it when the cunning bastards wheeled right and left, making for the corners of the fort. We let fly just the same, and I dispatched three-quarters of our force around the other ramparts. Even spread thin, we could put up enough fire to keep them at a distance. And a merry, useless little fight ensued, the Indians darting in and out, our fellows blazing away from cover, and knocking one or two over, while the chief circled with a group of followers, for all the world like a general with his staff, looking to spot the best place for a concerted rush. I was taking my time with a Colt rifle, trying long pots at him and damning the sights, when Grattan was at my elbow again. Just at that moment, a fire arrow came whistling over and stuck smouldering in the parapet behind us. A teamster stamped it up, but it gave point to what could say.
"Are you ready for bad news?"
says he, and for all he tried to keep the jaunty note in his voice, there was a wild glint in his eye.
"Because I'm the one that's got it, begod. That armory in the Northwest Tower, there. Aye, well, some clever fellows laid a powder train to the magazine, and there's enough loose powder lying about to give an artilleryman the trots, with a burned-out slow fuse in the middle of it. Not only that, in the opposite tower there's 80 kegs of the stuff, and another train to them. Which means," says he, and the sweat on his face wasn't from heat or exertion, "that whoever abandoned this fort intended to blow it sky high, and would have done, but for that faulty fuse."
By this time, you'll understand, I'd left off shooting, and was giving the man my most earnest attention, palsied with fright.
"You follow me, Captain?" says he. "We're sitting in the middle of a powder keg, and one spark will blow the whole place to kingdom come."
Now, you may not be aware, gentle reader, in these civilized days of manufactured cartridges and cased shells, precisely what a powder train was. Skillful sappers used to make them by piercing large cartridges with a bodkin and carrying the cartridge rapidly away so that the powder trickled out in a stream no thicker than a pencil lead, which they ran to the charge to be detonated. In the case of Bent's fort, I gathered several tons of high explosive with a similar confection in the opposite tower, just for luck. At the start of the powder train, you placed a slow-burning fuse to enable you to get over the skyline before November the 5th. Such a train is hard to see even by daylight, since it's just a thin line of dust, and Grattan and I had barely glanced into the towers and hadn't been looking for trains or loose powder anyway. But there they were, waiting for a spark, and hostile Indians had just started shooting fire arrows at us. I said, "What do you advise?" Your words to that effect. He didn't know, so we had a brief discussion, the fruit of which was one of the rottenest ideas I've ever heard. My own first thought was to get over the wall, but with the Upper Arkansas Hairdressers Association on hand, that wouldn't answer. And when Grattan proposed that the sluts should set to work carefully to sweep up the powder trains, I was fool enough to agree. He must have been as panic-fevered as I was, for he had six of them lined up at the Northwest Tower before the suicidal folly of it came home to me. Loose powder is as vicious an article as the plague germ. The friction of a foot can set it off, and the thought of those handless harlots scraping among it brought me down from the parapet like a stung ferret. "It won't do," I bawled. "Water from the well. Can you douse the trains?"
"If I could, there's still the magazine and another pile of kegs yonder big enough to blow us to Mexico," says Grattan. "We'll never soak them all."
And at that moment another fire arrow came winging into the square and stuck blazing in Susie's coach. Clearney screamed and the girls beat it out with cloths. I absolutely tore my hair in fear and consternation. "Get the invalids," I shouted. "Buckets of water. Post that doddering buggers about the place with as many buckets as you can find. The girls can make a chain from the well. We'll need them on the parapets too. Hurry, for Christ's sake, and make sure the tower doors are fast and soaked in water." It was the only thing to be done. The invalids and girls must douse every burning missile the moment it struck. The mines were in stout-walled buildings, and short of a general fire, they'd be harmless enough. Once we'd beaten off our feathered friends, we could set to work cautiously to remove the trains and kegs. In the meantime, it was back to the walls and try to sicken our attackers. They were still full of sin and impudence, though, and had mounted a determined rush against the west wall from the corral. But the Savanieros had made cool practice, and there were half a dozen painted corpses under the wall to prove it. Our fellows had discovered the best field of fire was from the towers, which projected sufficiently to enfilade two walls at once. We had thinned our attackers out a little anyway, and no others had appeared. All told, there were perhaps 50, mostly on the north side, where there were no battlements but only upper bedrooms with flat, unparapeted roofs. So far, I don't believe we'd taken even a flesh wound on our side. Suddenly they charged again, and the 11th Hussars couldn't have done it better. They came singly, and in little packs, all along the north and east sides, converging at the last minute at the northeast angle, where there were windows in the upper floor, and our range was the greatest. We blazed down the wall for dear life, some of the Savagneros exposing themselves recklessly, for if just one of the bastards got inside, we might be well done for. We hadn't the men to go hunting through the fort. They surged under the wall, scrambling up on their ponies' backs and leaping for the sill. We were firing into the brown and doing fearful execution, but a Colt revolving rifle takes time to reload, and if they hadn't desisted when they did, I believe they might have got a man in. They rode off howling, leaving dead and dying under the wall. And then screams of alarm from the courtyard brought us round to meet an even deadlier menace. While we were engaged on the wall, a few fire arrows had come over and been promptly stifled by the invalids, who were in tremendous trim, bawling orders to each other and striding about like Nelson on the quarterdeck. But bowmen firing from behind the corral had put a couple of burning shafts into the roof of the stable against the west wall. It was wattle, and went up like a muslin curtain with a great whoosh. It only burned for a few minutes, but sparks must have reached the roof of the billiard room, for presently it began to flame, and the invalids had to beat a retreat, roaring for more water. If the Indians had come in then, in one spot, neck or nothing, we'd have been done for. But they circled at a distance still, yelling, apparently content to let the fire do the work for a while. Which meant that we had a respite, and I was able to gibber in futile anguish. The girls at the well were running with buckets for the west steps, but I could see with half an eye that the billiard room was beyond hope. And from that, the farmers spread across the whole west end of the fort, consuming the beams on which the adobe was plastered, raging out of control, until it reached the northwest tower with its tons of powder. That explosion would set the whole place alight, and the other tower would go up as well. But we'd be past caring by then. We'd all be blown to atoms or roasted in the burning ruins. At such times, when hope is dead and there's nowhere to hide, it's astonishing how the mind clears, and you see, with an icy brilliance of logic, that there's nothing for it but to run like hell. Fortunately, another man who'd considered that possibility, about 10 minutes before I had, was Grattan Nugent Hare, late of the Cheney 10th and U.S. Dragoons. In the brief space between organizing the Bucket Brigade and the Indians' attack on the northeast angle, he'd been sending down every other Savagnero and teamster to put to the mule teams on the three coaches, and on a couple of the wagons in the little park behind the shops on the southern side. When I came bounding down from the northwest tower, he met me at the steps and nodded at the blaze that was spreading across the west roof. The heat was like a furnace. "We'll have to break out," he shouted. "We've maybe got 10 minutes before yon terror goes up. If we throw open the gates, we can make a run for it with the wagons." "Where the hell to?" I demanded. "The river. It's barely a furlong from the south wall. If we can get the coaches and a couple of wagons that far, we can corral and hold them off. It's that or be blown to blazes." Now, beastly funk I may be, but show me the ghost of a loophole, and I can think as smart as the next man, and be through it first, too, with luck. The three coaches were hitched up in the square, and a teamster was leading a wagon team from the park. Black smoke was swirling across from the west side, and the beasts shied and bellowed with fear. From the two towers, a couple of Savagneros were firing occasional shots. Evidently, the Indians were still content to hold off. Grattan's voice was hoarse. "The women in the three coaches with the three best drivers and a rifleman to each coach. Aye, and the invalids with a few revolvers. That'll leave us 6 or 7 of us to man the southeast tower and cover them as they drive for the river. If a savage gets within touch of them, we should be ashamed of our shooting."
"What then?"
"When they made the river, we'll break out with a couple of wagons. The redskins will be ready, but there ain't about 50 of them. With luck, we'll maul them bad enough to leave us alone."
You may imagine this conversation punctuated by the crackle of burning timber, wenches wailing and coughing, shots banging overhead, and the bespectacled invalid coming to attention, crying,
"We are at your disposal, sir. Cincinnati shall not fail. Name our task, and it shall be done, yea, even unto the end."
I gave him a revolver and shoved him into the first coach along with a brave but tearful Susie, who gave me a hasty slobber, and four terrified prostitutes. Grattan made for the gates while the coach drivers hustled the other tarts and invalids into their vehicles, packing them like herring. I took a quick glance at the west wall. The blacksmith shop was ablaze now, and the flames were licking towards the catwalk leading to the northwest tower. Dear God, would the heat set off the loose powder even before the flames got close? I went up the steps to the southeast tower, four at a time. Outside the fort, our attackers were still keeping their distance, most of them on the north side, which was all to the good. I looked across to the northwest tower, and there were two Sabaneros there, and I waved them across. If any Indians wanted to attack through the fire that was now shooting above the west wall, good luck to him. Down in the courtyard, the drivers were in their places. A teamster with a rifle was at the window of the first coach. On the second, a Sabanero was sitting on the roof, reloading his Colt. With all the din, I never heard the gates open. Suddenly, the lead driver was yahooing and whipping up, and we rushed to the parapet of the tower, rifles at the ready. As we looked down, the first coach shot out and wheeled right for the river, and a tremendous yell burst from the startled Indians, who came tearing in at the unexpected sally. Then the second coach, and we were firing as fast as we could, picking our men pretty neatly, I like to think. The main pursuit had to come close to the gate wall, and we fairly shot them flat. They must have lost a dozen riders in their first mad rush, and the three coaches were careering down for the river, with the red sticks yelling in fury, circling out to get at them, losing distance in their attempt to get away from our fire. The first coach reached the river and wheeled among the cottonwoods, and then the second, lurching and bouncing on the rough prairie, lost a wheel with about 20 yards to go. But the driver must have cut the traces, for the mules ran loose, and there wasn't an Indian close enough, thanks to our shooting and the rifle in the first coach, to do any damage, as the girls and their guards scrambled out and reached the safety of the trees. The third coach, with its Sabanero performing like Deadwood Dick, came to rest beside the first one, and a tremendous cheer broke from our bastion. Grattan was down in the courtyard yelling to us, and our fellows fairly tumbled down the steps to the wagons. I took a shot of the eye around. The Indians had pulled off on the east side, milling about 200 yards or so from the fort gate. On the south side, between the fort and the coaches at the river, there wasn't a savage to be seen. "Come on!" bawls Grattan. He and the fellows were piling into the two wagons, preparing to make the run. "Out you go!" roars the gallant Flashy. "I'll cover you!" He stared, but didn't hesitate above a second. He sprang up beside the teamster, and the wagon lumbered into the gateway. Now, you may be staring too, for you will have concluded that it ain't quite my style to be the last man out of the beleaguered garrison. And right you are. But if I have to fly from a fight, I prefer to do it me own way. And for the past 5 minutes at least, I've been reflecting that my way was certainly not in one of those crazy wagons. As I saw it, there were at least 40 Indians out yonder, and they weren't going to be taken by surprise a second time. Those wagons were going to have their beasts hamstrung before they got near the river, and then it would be every man for himself on foot. Odds on a man from the wagons getting to the river? About evens, and that ain't good enough when there's a safer way out. One thing was certain, you see, with all the fun and frolic to the south and east of the fort, there wouldn't be a brave left on the north side, and during our defense of the walls, I noticed an interesting thing. Whenever an Indian fell, more often than not his pony stayed by the body. Now, that's nothing new, as any cavalryman knows. Why, at Balaclava, in the hell of that Russian battery, I recall at least two of our mounts nuzzling at fallen troopers, and these redskins and their horses are close as lovers. After the attack on the northeast angle, there'd been three or four ponies standing, heads hanging and lost, beside the Indian dead at the foot of the wall, and I was certain they'd still be there. I could drop from a window on the north side, climb aboard, and be off and away round the fort, coming down to the carriages at the river by the west side, while Grattan and the lads occupied the Indians to the east and stopped any arrows that might be going. One last glance to be sure the northwest tower was still unscathed, and as the second wagon surged out of the gate and Indian yelling redoubled,
I was scuttling nimbly along the east parapet above the gateway and into the end upper-story room on the north wall. I sped across to the window and took a cautious peep. Not a soul in sight as far as the eye could see. And there, below, beside the tangle of red corpses, were two Indian ponies. "Your luck's in again, old Flash," thinks I, chuckling as I gripped the frame to climb. And the room was shuddering like a matchbox in a giant's hand. A most appalling blast of thunder filled my ears. The floor gave way beneath me, and I was falling through dense clouds of dust or smoke, crashing down with a shock that drove the breath out of me, and with a ghastly pain stabbing through my left ankle. I believe it was that pain that kept me conscious. I was in clouds of swirling dust, choking as I tried to scramble on all fours. For seconds I was too dizzy to see, and then there was light before me from an open doorway, and I lunged towards it. I knew I must be in the ground floor room. Above me the ceiling had gone, and there were beams and broken timbers all about me. I reached the doorway and fell through it. To my right, the west end of the fort, was an inferno. I knew the magazine had gone, and most of the northwest angle with it. But the northern rooms were blazing too, and the thatched arcade across the square was beginning to burn. The gate wall was unscathed, but there were 80 kegs of powder in the tower at the far end of it, and with flaming wreckage all over the courtyard, they might blow any instant. I plunged forward and fell with the sickening pain in my ankle, but I crawled feebly on through the fiery reek, coughing and swearing, and I don't doubt praying. The roar of burning seemed to be everywhere, but not 20 yards ahead was the yawning gateway. If I could only scramble to it before the mine went up and didn't lose consciousness on the way. I learned something that day. If you've a sprained or broken leg and want to make haste, don't crawl, roll. Your leg will give you jip at every turn, especially if your way is strewn with flaming rubble. But if you're lucky, you'll get there. I don't know how long it took, perhaps a minute, though it seemed an eternity, through which I babbled in terror and shrieked with agony. My clothes were smouldering, but now I could see, with my eyes streaming, through the gateway to the prairie beyond. I half got to my feet and fairly threw myself under the arch, rolling for dear life. I remember a massive iron hinge at which I clutched, dragging myself along by sheer main force of my arms, and rolled again. I must be beyond the gates, but even then I struggled ahead, my face in the dust, inching on to try to escape the horror behind me. Perhaps I fainted more than once. I can't tell. I thought I heard a muffled crash from behind, but I didn't mind it. I dug in my fingernails and pulled, until I could no more. I rested my face on one side, and above the scrubby grass in my line of sight, there were the legs of a pony, and I hardly had time to think, "Oh, dear Jesus, the Indians!" when a hand took me by the shoulder and rolled me over, and I was blinking up into a monstrously bearded face under a fur cap, and I pawed feebly at a fringed buckskin shirt that was slick with wear, and then the beard split into a huge grin of white teeth, and a voice said, "Well, old house, what battle? How your symptoms, Sigasotin? Say, if there was just a spoonful of gravy to go with you, I reckon you're baked just about good enough to eat."
Chapter 8. It's a curious distinction on which I've dined out in Yankee clubs more than once, that I was the last man in Bent's Fort, for it's never been rebuilt. And when I saw it a few years ago, it was just a heap of ruins, with the white wolves prowling through it. What caused me to reflect, though, on the damnable unfairness of things, was that I could have been last out in perfect safety, if I hadn't been so set on preserving my own skin. There's a moral there, I suppose, but not one I've ever paid the least heed to. What had happened was this. Just as a second wagon emerged, and the Indians were preparing to give it toco, who should even view down the trail but a party of mountain men, drawn by the smoke and sound of general uproar. They don't stand on ceremony, those fellows. One swift survey and they were charging in like the heavy brigade. And since there were 20 of them, the Indians had lost no time in making tracks, leaving a fair few of their number on the grass. So our chaps in the wagons, whom I'd supposed were going to likely death or capture, had enjoyed a grandstand seat in perfect safety,
while poor old Flashy had been browning nicely and damn lucky not to be overdone. Mind you, there were compensations, as the one serious casualty on our side, for it's a remarkable thing that out of all who'd been in the fort, only one of the Savagneros had taken an arrow in the leg, and Claudia had broken her wrist when the second carriage foundered. I was the centre of attention. Susie, who had borne up like Grace Darling all through, went into floods at the sight of my poor singed carcass, and the invalids bustled about with hot fomentations and bread poultices and sound advice, which I dare say would have carried me off if the mountain men hadn't patiently lifted them aside, bandaged my sprained ankle, and soothed my burns with a most disgusting mixture of herbs and bear's grease. The most signal behaviour, though, had been Claire's. She'd gone into hysterics when I was borne down to the carriages, still smoking gently, and had had to be restrained from flinging herself on me. Well, I hadn't known the wench cared that much. It wasn't like the cool Clairney's style at all, and gave me some pause. Susie seemed too distraught about me to notice this signal display of concern for Massa by his handmaiden, which was just as well. My burns were trivial enough, by the way, but my ankle kept me coach-bound for a fortnight, by which time we were on our way again. With the mountain men was one Fitzpatrick, who was a big man in those parts, and on his advice we waited until a caravan arrived from the east, which he and the mountain men joined for Santa Fe. There was every kind of Indian trouble to the south, apparently, but in a train that was eventually 100 wagons strong, we had no fears. We learned from Fitzpatrick that the big tribe of Indians we'd seen on our way to Bent's were Comanches, who were celebrated both as bitter enemies of the Cheyenne and for their medical skill. Whether they were out to take their foes at a disadvantage or study the cholera epidemic was a moot point. The fellows who besieged us at Bent's were a mixed band of Utes, who hated everybody, and chief dog Kiowas, who were reckoned friendly but had not been able to resist the temptation of our small caravan. But from now on, whenever Indians were mentioned, we began to hear a new and ominous name, Parshis. Even the sound of it was vicious, and the mountain men would growl and shake their heads. I didn't care if I never saw a red hide again. But in fact, Fitzpatrick swore that we'd been lucky. We'd lost 3 teamsters and 2 wagons on the mad career into Bent's, but nothing except a little gear in the destruction of the fort itself. By a freak of the explosion, the south wall had collapsed, exposing the wagon park, and the mountain men and Savagneros had taken advantage of a change in the wind to haul our last 4 wagons clear. So, apart from 1 load of claret and another of food, our goods were fairly intact, much to Susie's relief. But Bent's was a sorry sight. The explosion had raised a third of it, and the fire eventually destroyed the rest, including the southeast tower and its powder kegs, which oddly enough never blew up, but burned like an enormous Roman candle that I'm told was seen by the soldiers at Fort Mann, more than 150 miles away. The mountain men were fearfully cut up about it. To them it was as great a thing as the destruction of St. Paul's or the Tower would be to us, perhaps even greater. I remember 3 of them talking softly near the coach at sundown, the night before we pulled out for Santa Fe, smoking their pipes as they watched the ruins silhouetted against the purple sky as the last of the light faded. "Remember when I first see Bent's, coming down with the Green River boys from South Park now 15 years ago. Didn't rightly believe my eyes, expected a giant to come out on it, hollering fee-fi-fo. Didn't think nothing could tumble it down. Grown to be right lonely, that big lodge. Lonely? Why, you jackass, how you talk. How can you be lonely for a place? Lonely is for folks." A long pause. "Maybe so. All this cool, no. If you'n scraping for beaver on the powder, or bogged in a Blackfeet village in the Tetons come winter, you can get right desolated, just wishing you could walk in under that gate. See St. Vrain and Maxwell laughing on the verandy and smoking them big cigars, and the little white man himself a-settin' by the hide press counting the pelts, jealous-like.
or old Bill cussing and yarning with the smith. Or feel a taste of Black Sue's pumpkin pie, you mean?
Sure enough, this child could swallow a buffalo bull, horns, tail, and snout, and still have room for that pot.
That's what I'm a-saying, though. Tain't the place you're hankering for, it's the folks. And the pie, seemingly. Well, the folks is still around, ain't they?
Reckon. Howsomever, they can't come to Bent's no more, 'cause tain't here. And they won't be, seems like, without Bent's.
In course they will, you darn old fool. They be until they die, leastways. Can't be any longer than that.
They could be, insists the prairie Plato, if Big Lodge was. Now it gone, and soon nobody remember it. Like not many remember the old rendezvous up in the Green and Bighorn. Back before the Santa Fe traders come. Why, I remember those. What's special about them?
Nothing, except they ain't nowadays. And this old horse can get lonely for them, too. That's my point.
I reckon you could get lonely for the old price of beaver.
Can that, and have done since 36.
They all laughed.
Get lonely for all the things as it's changing. Why, it getting so a cuss can't walk 50 miles without seeing a soldier or a hemigrant. But makes me feel right scary, hell-wise.
Tapping his breast.
To think a Big Lodge gone. Place and folks. Seems it was kind of like home.
Home? Why, your home was in Kentucky till you bust the minister's window and head to Vamoose. Since when a home's been wherever you found a fat squaw and a good fire?
Them's the places I used to start yearning for Bent's,
cries the old chap.
That proves it. That's my point. That's why I'm grieving to see it all broke down like that.
Well, so am I, but the way you talk, you'd have been happier if in Big Lodge had never been built in the first place.
No, don't you see? Then, why, there'd be nothing to remember, not to forget.
The grass was beginning to bound when our reinforced train rolled down the timbers toward the distant mountains. It was a shame that our invalids, having had as much of the West's health-giving properties as they could stand, had turned back from Bent's, for there's no air in the world as invigorating as New Mexico's. We journeyed across prairie, bright with flowers, and it was bliss to lie in the coach watching the girls running and laughing among them like muslin butterflies, gathering them in great armfuls and filling our coach with their fragrance. Even when we began to climb into the craggy forest hills that lead up to the Raton Pass, and the going got slower, the land was still beautiful, with its winding wooded valleys. There's a fine toll road now, I believe, but in my time there was hardly a visible trail, and once or twice the wagons had to be carried bodily over rocky barriers.